This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. As we demand justice for Trayvon Martin, his death reveals a long-frayed racial nerve. And now, the murder of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, an unarmed black youth in Sanford, Florida, who was shot by George Zimmerman, cloaked in the reactionary Stand Your Ground law, is a crime against humanity and a violation of human rights.
The refusal of the Sanford Police Department to arrest George Zimmerman, despite having evidence that he pursued Trayvon and aired profanity and seemingly racial epithets, along with the cover-up actions by the Sanford Police Department, sends an age-old racist message that black people have no rights that a white person is bound to respect. We'll examine the demands of the arrest of Zimmerman, the temporary stepping down of the Sanford Police Chief,
and we'll analyze the role of the National Rifle Association, whose vision for America is embodied in this tragic shooting, with a successful push for the enactment of laws for carrying of concealed weapons, and the Stand Your Ground law, which has been referred to as the Shoot to Kill law.
We're joined by Professor Lynn Washington. He is professor of journalism at Temple University, and Colin Goddard, who was shot 4 times at the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre and is assistant director of federal legislation for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. I'd like to begin with Lynn Washington, who has written a tremendously important, salient argument about the role of race within the context of the murder of Trayvon Martin. And Professor Washington, elaborate on that, because there are people who would simply say, while they condemn the death of Trayvon, that it is not about black and white, it's about what's right or wrong. What is the issue here?
Well, those who say that this issue is about right and wrong are right. And those who correctly note the racialized context of this are also right. More specific to your question, the issue of race and racism has been intertwined with American law since the inception of this country. And that was one of the things that I tried to bring out in a piece that I recently wrote. What you just talked about in terms of saying the blacks have no rights that whites are bound to respect, that was a direct quote from a Supreme Court, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling on the eve of the Civil War. I think it was in 1857. Incredibly, this very important issue of racism in the law is rarely taught in law schools. So we have lawyers, we have legislators who are lawyers, and we have judges and others in the various layers of the justice system who have no clue about the very vibrant and, I would also say, violent life that racism plays in the very law that they purport to uphold and are sworn to every day.
One of the other things that I just want to link together here, this was a private citizen, George Zimmerman. We're not unfamiliar with that circumstance. But the role of George Zimmerman in conjunction with the refusal of the police department to arrest George Zimmerman in any event on the most elementary kind of policing level to hold him, and further the destruction or the omission, certainly, of vital evidence. Where do the two fit together as part of the racism that is prevalent against black youth in our society?
Well, when we look at not only what happened and what has been happening there being Sanford of Florida, we see a history of disparate treatment where the abuses either by police against persons of color or the actual shootings of those people, fatal shootings, we see that the police in that town have historically, and I'm not talking taking it all the way back to Seminole, Florida, when there when the U.S. government went in and did a Vietnam-type war for almost 17 years to try to break up the alliances between Native Americans and African Americans, meaning them runaway slaves. But I'm talking about within the last 5 to 7 years, there have been incidences where there have been shootings of African Americans, and the police department has essentially turned a cold shoulder, as they did in the Trayvon Martin case. And the problem here is that because of that very recent history, within the context of past history, be it 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 25, 35 years ago, that's what strikes a chord, and that's when people say, hey, wait a minute. We've seen this before. You've said that, you know, this stuff is not going to happen anymore, and it continues to replicate itself time after time after time, and that is what is bringing out a lot of this national outrage that you see.
And Colin Goddard from the Brady Campaign, how does the loosening of gun control laws and the Stand Your Ground law in Florida, which is spreading throughout the country, how does that impact on this case that we're talking about now, the murder of Trayvon Martin?
Well, first, I think the loosening of the law has ultimately allowed Trayvon to encounter an armed private citizen. And Florida is notorious in this country for issuing permits to citizens, not even in Florida, but people who live in other states, with very low standards. And unfortunately, that put those two individuals on a path to meet each other that evening a month ago, when one of them was armed with the ability to kill the other with a flick of a finger. And coupled with that, there is another law, everyone know is the Stand Your Ground law, or we call Shoot First, Ask Questions Later law, that gives people, emboldens them to go out in public with a deadly weapon and feel like that is an option that they can use if it's appropriate. And both of these, you know, dropping the standards to get a permit to carry a loaded gun in public and allowing people to use deadly force in public if they have any threat against them perceived, have been supported by the National Rifle Association, instituted in Florida first, and then replicated across this country. Florida has been the laboratory for dangerous gun policy. And so when we heard about this incident happening, we were not surprised that it happened in Florida.
Could you flesh out what this Stand Your Ground law means exactly?
Well, there is what's called common law castle doctrine, which says that basically you as a homeowner are king of your castle, and your private property and what happens on it is under your control, and you are allowed to use deadly force when in the confines of your home. Stand Your Ground law has opened the confines, not just from your home, to any place where you have a legal right to be, and also removed the previous requirement for you to retreat, a duty to retreat from a situation if you could do so, and instead says that if you are met with force, you can use force, including deadly force, if you have a threat or perceived threat on your own well-being. And so not only is that dangerous public policy that allows people who shoot and kill other people to hide behind it and avoid prosecution, which is the case here in Mr. Zimmerman, but it also emboldens them in generally, and you've seen that with the massive increase in the number of justifiable homicides in Florida where people have shot unarmed people multiple times. Trayvon Martin's case is not the first.
Going back to Lynn Washington, one of the recent developments, and for many of us who have followed the death of young African-Americans for many years, whether at the hands of private citizens or at the hands of the policing apparatus of the state, suddenly there is an attempt to really slander, to cast dispersion on really the personage of Trayvon Martin, and also within the Atlanta Sentinel, there is leakage of information that would seem to lead to that Trayvon, young 17-year-old, slight of person, Trayvon was the aggressor, despite all the tapes that we've heard, et cetera. What are we to make and understand about that as the case progresses, albeit terribly slowly, and we continue to seek justice for Trayvon?
Well, what we are seeing now is a very sophisticated, very deliberate orchestration of a blame the victim. The issue is what happened that night. The issue is what the police didn't do about what happened that night. If in fact Mr. Martin punched Mr. Zimmerman and knocked him down and broke his nose and everything like that, I mean, everybody's been very polite in referencing Zimmerman as Mr. Zimmerman. If that's what happened, this is the biggest punk in the world. For a man to be, you know, taller and heavier, to be knocked down. But let's listen to the tape. Let's follow the evidence. Zimmerman is now claiming, through this leak that came from the police department and was attributed to unidentified sources in the police department, he says that he was returning to his vehicle when, in fact, he was attacked by Martin. Well, that begs the question, what was he doing outside of his vehicle when the police told him very clearly, or should I say the 911 dispatcher, told him very clearly not to get involved in this? So regardless of any way you spin this, legally, even within the very loose confines of this Florida law, this outrageous law, there is no defense within that. And I want to remember, I mean, we're talking about the context of this and the roots, the legs on this. In 1990, the Florida State Supreme Court issued a study on race bias. And one of the things that they said that was that extensive evidence suggests that minorities are too often subjected to the threat of abuse and brutality by law enforcement organizations in Florida. What was identified in 1990 is what we're seeing happening today in 2012.
Colin, what has been the history of the actions by Florida police with regard to cases where there have been use of firearms by patrols, by people who are standing their ground? What have the Florida police done to counter excesses and use of firearms?
That's a good question, and I think probably a very long answer, but I do know that the police response to such situation did change after the adoption of Florida's Shoot First law. And like I said, it changed the game. And now I even heard on a previous media outlet a representative from the Sanford Police Department say, look, if we go down the road of an arrest of Mr. Zimmerman, then we open ourselves up to litigation and lawsuits. And if you're thinking from a law enforcement officer's perspective, head of a unit, anything that could cripple the organization would be something that they would rather avoid. And unfortunately, it's put them in this situation, you know, and they've made decisions to put themselves in there as well, that we're currently in it, and it makes them look very bad, and it makes the handling of this entire issue look even worse.
There's also the issue of concealed guns. I don't want to ignore that as well. You know, Florida chief, police chiefs actually predicted back in 2005 when the Stand Your Ground law passed that the law would be used to justify killings ranging from what they called at that time drug dealers, turf battles, to road rage incidents, homicides characterized as justifiable, in fact, have nearly tripled since the law went into effect. So you come to this from a very personal perspective, Colin. So what is your response to where we're at with concealed weapons and where we're at with the Stand Your Ground law, which is now in effect in almost 20 states?
Well, I just fundamentally don't believe that introducing a firearm into a conflict situation helps resolve that conflict in a peaceful manner. I mean, it escalates situations that could be avoided, in my opinion. And as I said before, Florida is notorious in the country of issuing permits to people that shouldn't have them. And an Orlando Sun Sentinel review of who has obtained these permits in the early 2000s revealed that Florida issued permits to over 1,400 people who have pleaded guilty to a felony. A number of sexual predators and people with active arrest warrants. And upon the revelation in the general media of that, Florida's concealed carry requirements or concealed carry process was not overhauled, was not updated, was not improved. Rather, the Florida legislature, with help of the National Rifle Association yet again, shielded from public knowledge the information behind concealed carry holders, so no such report could ever be done similar to that in the future.
And Lynn Washington, one of the things that I'm interested in, Angela Corey, who was appointed as the effective special prosecutor by Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, I mean, she does have it within her power at this juncture still to arrest Zimmerman and let the process of justice, if you will, begin to take its course. So is there any real sense of optimism despite the mass outpouring of sentiment by the communities throughout this country for justice for Trayvon? Is there any real sense that the Florida system is capable of moving in a way that will take its course for justice, or is it strictly that we're going to have to rely on a federal investigation?
Well, there's always the hope and the anticipation that the law enforcement authorities will operate in a just and in a standard manner. And one of the elements of outrage in this case is that the authorities there have not been operating in what has been their SOP, their standard operating procedure. One of the things that always comes up is that if it was reversed, if it was a Trayvon Martin shooting a George Zimmerman, there would have been an arrest immediately. Now, arrest does not mean a conviction or imprisonment. It just means that the law is followed. Why is this case now going through a grand jury process, which in some ways has been notorious in terms of absolving outrageous and very racist conduct all around the country? So I think that how far in we are with this and the backsliding and backstepping that has come from the authority side of this equation, I don't think that anything that they do is going to really bolster that public confidence, that public trust that is needed. They should have acted weeks ago, months ago, but we have to understand we are not in a post-racial era in the United States. And I don't want to keep hitting on the race piece too much because this basically is right and wrong. There was a crime committed, and the authorities there have yet to step up and treat this as the crime that it is, based clearly on evidence that you don't need a law degree or a PhD in history or sociology or anything else to see that this is wrong.
And, Colin, we're, you know, want to look at the issues, certainly, of guns as well. Guns kill. That's what they do. Should there be a demand, is this an opportunity as well for the repeal of this Stand Your Ground law, which, as I mentioned, is in effect in at least 20 states and is actually heading to the books, et cetera, in New York and a number of other northern venues as well?
Absolutely. I believe I've seen some activity along those lines of trying to have that reviewed, not only by members of the public, but also by members in the Florida Senate. And I hope that that is a thorough investigation, a thorough review that was unfortunately not apparently done when it was voted on in 2005. But what I think is more alarming is the reaction of some of the federal elected officials since the shooting of Trayvon Martin. 16 days after Trayvon was killed, three Democrats in the United States Senate, backed by the National Rifle Association, introduced a bill that would allow the George Zimmermans of the world, people with permits to carry loaded concealed weapons in public, in their home state, to carry in every other state. No matter if other states have enacted like New York, other provisions to limit the number of people carrying. George Zimmerman would be allowed, and still is because he has a permit now, to carry in Times Square with NYPD totally unable to do anything until he pulled the trigger. And so that has been our response from our elected officials in the Senate. And it blows my mind how that legislation is moving as more information is coming out about this trial. It is just bad public policy.
How powerful is the National Rifle Association?
Well, I think a lot of it is their perception of power. I think the National Rifle Association knows how to play the game here in Washington, D.C., knows where to put its money and when, probably better than any other group, and it has an industry to stand behind and an industry to give them financial support to do so. You know, it's no longer just about a sportsman or a hunter. These are people getting millions of dollars from those who profit from the sale of firearms. So, you know, I think these are all bad public policies, but these are great market expansion policies if you're trying to increase revenues. And by allowing more people to carry more guns in more places, you're going to have more gun sales. And that's ultimately where it is, falls at the end of the day for groups like the National Rifle Association. But unfortunately, that puts a lot of American citizens in danger. I mean, we have the worst problem with gun violence in the modern industrialized world, yet we seem to think that our solution to it is to allow more people to carry more guns in more places. If that idea was true, we would already be the safest country in the world, and we are quite the opposite.
And, Colin, how do people follow this with the Brady campaign? What's your website?
You can check us out at bradycampaign.org, as well as we have a very active Twitter presence at BradyBuzz, B-U-Z-Z, and keep up with statements from our new president, Dan Gross, and we'll keep on top of groups like the National Rifle Association and ALEC, which is a group that's supporting their legislation and copying it in states across the country.
Lynn Washington, tell us the name of the article that you recently wrote, because people should Google it.
It was, I'm just trying to bring it up right now. Because it was
how fast
on
we
a number
forget.
Of different, yeah, number of different sites. It's called White Sheets Surround Florida Teens Slain.
And do you think that the Florida Sanford Police Department should be subject to investigation as well?
Oh, absolutely. There's currently an investigation by the U.S. Justice Department into the Miami Police Department for its shooting of eight African-Americans in an 8 or 10 month period. Colin makes some very good points about the irresponsibility of our elected officials. Last week in Louisiana, there was scenes of Rick Santorum doing a campaign stop at a gun range. When this issue of this unprovoked and illegal shooting is raging across the country, and this business about guns, I mean, we are now arming or legally allowing citizens to possess and use guns at lower standards than what we have for police. Hmm. If this was a police-involved shooting, the police officer would be off the street. Not arrested, but off the street, unless it was evidence of something. Guns will be checked. I mean, this is crazy. I mean, you know, I go in, hey, I want a gun. I don't have to know how to shoot it. I don't have to know how to load it, clean it, anything about it. And there's just something horribly wrong with this.
And we've been speaking with Lynn Washington, professor of journalism at Temple University, and Colin Goddard, who, as I indicated, had been shot four times at the 2007 Virginia Tech massacre himself, and is assistant director of federal legislation for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, as we continue, all of us, to press for justice for Trayvon Martin. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.